Christine Nash, Assistant Public Defender, Collins Counsel, Aaron J. Campbell, Assistant Attorney General, and Kelly Campbell.
You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Jenna C. Nutt. I'm from the Public Defender's Office. Before I begin, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. And I represent Wayne Cahoon. Mr. Cahoon was convicted of possession with intent to distribute and conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute Schedule II drugs. I'd like to start with the conspiracy charge. This case gets a little bit confusing because there are two different Schedule I or II drugs. There's morphine and oxycodone. The conspiracy dealt with the oxycodone, which his brother Roy possessed in his pocket. Mr. Cahoon was convicted of conspiracy with that of that charge. What the Commonwealth and what the evidence relied on was a note that Wayne Cahoon had in his pocket that referenced oxycodone. However, what's important to point out is that that note did not in any way reference the oxycodone that was possessed at the time. It was different milligrams. It was different amounts. There was nothing even to say that that note referenced any oxycodone that Roy, his brother, ever possessed.
So the note should have said Roy's oxycodone, and then that would have allowed the fact-finding by the...
I think that that would have been a closer, a way to get there closer, but it doesn't necessarily create an agreement, because with the conspiracy it has to be an agreement, not just assistance or help. But it didn't say Roy's oxycodone. Wayne had a prescription as well for morphine. There's nothing to say that that note didn't reference some pills that Wayne might have had in the past.
I thought it was also significant from your perspective that the note concerned a different dosage of oxycodone than what his brother had.
That's correct.
So it couldn't have been applied to those specific pills he had in his pocket.
Correct. And the Commonwealth's expert in drugs testified to that there's no way that this note could be about those pills at all.
But if you know the price of a gram, can't you do the math?
Anyone could do the math.
I could do that math.
$1 per milligram. So the math is very easy, and I think given that it's so easy, if it was about those pills, he could have easily done that math on a piece of paper as well. I think it's.
But if it's that easy, why would he need to do that math on a piece of paper?
It was quite a few pills, and so I don't know if he could have done the math in his head or not. I think that the significant point is that...
Not much faith in your client.
I'm a public defense. I didn't know that. I think the significant point, though, is that the note could not have been about these pills. So then also the...
So we had an older price list for the drugs they were distributing. So what?
So they're distributing even more than what they have in their possession.
For conspiracy, it has to be an agreement about these pills. It has to be the possession has to be contemporaneous.
What about the 50 pills that were missing?
I'm sorry?
What about the pills that were missing?
Of the oxycodone pills?
Mm-hmm.
Those oxycodone pills were in Roy's possession the entire time. There was no evidence presented that Wayne even knew about them. They were in Roy's pocket. Roy had them filled that day. There's no evidence that Wayne was there when they were filled, that Wayne was there when they went missing. Wayne is found with him 2 hours later in the same car. He could have dropped him off somewhere. There's infinite possibilities of what could happen in that time period that would make a reasonable fact finder see that Wayne would have known nothing about any possible distribution that Roy did. And I think that's what's important with conspiracy. In all of the case law, the person that's involved has to know that there's been a distribution. And in Foster, which I cite, the driver was found guilty of conspiracy because she had seen the distribution take place on multiple times. Another case that I cited is Williams, In that case, there was no conspiracy because even though each person, one person had the money, one person was driving, there was nothing to show that they in any way acted in concert or knew the part that the other played. And I think that's the case here, and that's why Mr. Cahoon's conspiracy charge should be dismissed.
But do the 50 missing morphine pills play any role in the sufficiency analysis on the oxycodone?
So the morphine was Wayne's prescription. But that prescription, importantly, had been filled 4 days prior. The morphine had been filled that day. So Wayne had his morphine for significantly longer. There were pills that were deemed missing from that prescription as well. First of all, Wayne did give an explanation for those pills. The Commonwealth challenged that explanation, but the facts show that the deputy did ask Wayne two different questions about the pills at different time periods. He couldn't remember the wording of the questions. Wayne at one point responded that the remaining pills were in his house. At another time, he responded the remaining pills he had used. He had this prescription for 4 days, so even the evidence at trial was that he consumed some of them. The Commonwealth asked their expert how many he would consume on a daily basis, and so there was evidence.
50 morphine pills in 4 days?
There were 10 left, so 50 pills was the difference. However, he would have taken some of them. So I think the Commonwealth's position was that around 40 were missing. That's assuming he took them exactly as prescribed, which they can't prove. But he wouldn't have taken all of those. However, you can also, even if you assume that some of those pills were distributed, again, the pills that matter are what he has, because the intent to distribute has to be contemporaneous with the possession. And what's important about that is the Commonwealth's expert who testified that oftentimes people will distribute some of their pills and keep some for their own personal use. Because of that piece of evidence, no reasonable fact finder could find beyond a reasonable doubt that those 10 remaining pills were for distribution. The Commonwealth's expert testified that those remaining pills could still be for personal use, the 10 left. And that's why he couldn't have been convicted of possession with intent to distribute morphine. Now, the trial court didn't specifically convict him of possession with intent to distribute morphine.
I mean, wouldn't that be more of a venue problem than a substantive problem? In other words, we don't know where he distributed them, but there's a logical inference that he couldn't have consumed that many because he'd be dead, and so therefore he distributed them. We just don't know where. It might have been anywhere up and down 95, but that's not what's before us.
But that it actually did come up in the trial because he was also charged with distribution, and that charge was struck by the trial court because the trial court found that they couldn't prove that any sort of distribution took place in Spotsylvania County. So, again, if he wasn't charged with distribution, he had possession with intent to distribute distribution, and even if he did distribute somewhere else, the elements are that he had to possess contemporaneously with the intent to distribute in Spotsylvania County, and that's not what the evidence was.
May I interrupt with this question? At trial, though, it was very clear that oxycodone and morphine could either one of those two independently justify conviction under both the warrant and the indictment. And the defense counsel's closing argument flat out said to the judge, I know I need to address both. Goes to the Court of Appeals, they affirm on morphine, they don't rule on oxycodone because it's unnecessary to rule on it. It comes to us, and you're asking us to reverse it on the morphine sufficiency, but you don't appeal the Court of Appeals' failure to rule in your favor, which you would have to get in order to get a vacature of your conviction, of the oxycodone. And while that is not the classic alternative argument, there are two separate grounds that justify the trial court's conviction, and one of them is not before us, and has not been brought before us. Isn't that a problem?
I don't think it is, Your Honor, because I think that what this court could do is strike the conspiracy and then remand the possession with intent to distribute back to the Court of Appeals because they explicitly did not take up that issue, even though we did appeal and
well, my point is, we could do that, of course, but there's no assignment of error arguing for that. There's no assignment of error. There's no argument saying that's the appropriate way to handle this. You asked for a vacature of your conviction based upon a sufficiency win on morphine, and the oxycodone sufficiency is staring us in the face, and it's unaddressed.
I think that Rule 517C2 talks about why we could not bring forth that argument, because what that rule says is that to appeal to the Supreme Court of Virginia, we have to appeal actions taken by the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals explicitly took no action on the possession with intent to distribute oxycodone.
But when you appeal a lower court to a higher court and your complaint is, I asked them to do something and they didn't do it, that's the action that you appeal. If your premise were right, it would radically change a lot of appellate review processes.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last.
Let me back up. If a trial court, if you make two arguments to a trial court, and the trial court accepts one and blows off the other for whatever reason, doesn't even address it, doesn't mention that they're not going to address it, that has to be an argument for appeal that it should have been addressed if you need to win both points to get the relief you want.
In this case, the trial court didn't blow off either argument. They just didn't.
But you're appealing from the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals addressed one of the two independent grounds.
They did, but what that shows is no action, respectfully, and so you can't. We couldn't appeal what they didn't. What they didn't err on, they didn't rule on that, and so what
right. You're in essence saying the Court of Appeals did not err in not ruling on that when they had an alternative basis to deny what you wanted.
Correct. They affirmed the conviction of possession with intent to distribute when no drug was delineated by the trial court.
And but so you have to win on both. You have to say there's insufficient on oxycodone and it's insufficient on morphine. The Court of Appeals says, well, we find it sufficient on morphine. Your response should be, it's not. And in fact, you should have said that, and you should have also said that it was insufficient on oxycodone.
Again, all I can say is that the way that we interpret the rule against 517C2, is that the Court of Appeals explicitly did not take action on that assignment of error. And so that's why it cannot be appealed to this court. I think I'm in my rebuttal time. Is there another question?
2:54.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Aaron Campbell on behalf of the Commonwealth. The Court should affirm the Court of Appeals and the trial court because the evidence was sufficient for a rational fact finder to convict on both of these charges. I'll start with possession with the intent to distribute the morphine. The defendant concedes that he was in possession of the morphine. The issue is whether there was evidence of intent to distribute. Is the Commonwealth's position, when considering all the circumstances of this case, a rational fact finder could have found sufficient evidence of intent. As with all intent cases, there's hardly ever any direct evidence of intent. Necessarily, almost every time, has to be proven by circumstantial evidence. And when you consider all the circumstantial evidence in this case, there was sufficient circumstantial evidence for a rational fact finder to convict on the possession of intent to distribute the morphine. As the court's already talked about, there were 50 missing pills from the morphine bottle that was the defendant's prescription that had been filled 4 days earlier. The Commonwealth's expert testified that the missing 50 pills over a period of 4 days, which would have been five times the recommended dosage of the bottle, is inconsistent with personal use. The defendant argues that, well, these last 10 pills, these were his personal stash. This is what he's left over for himself. I don't know if that argument was ever even made below. To the extent it was, the trial court certainly rejected it. A trial court's rejection of a hypothesis of innocence is entitled to deference on appeal, as the court is aware. Furthermore, if the defendant is conceding that he distributed 50 pills over a period of 4 days, it is a reasonable inference that he intended to distribute the last 10 pills.
But they didn't concede that point. You say if they conceded that they distributed 50 over 4 days.
It seems to be that they are conceding that now. They didn't concede it below.
Well, I didn't hear him concede it today either.
Well, the argument is, assuming that he did distribute the 50 morphine pills, then setting that aside, then the last 10 pills were just for his personal use.
I don't have a question.
Oh, okay. But looking at the other circumstantial evidence, I mean, the trial court had plenty of other circumstantial evidence that this defendant was engaged in the illegal distribution of prescription opiates. We have the inconsistent statements that he gave to the officer of where the missing pills were. He said they were in my jacket. I don't know why they would be in a jacket, but he said they were. And then he says he consumed all 50 pills over a period of four days. Let's not forget that he also had, there was suspicious behavior when the officer was following the vehicle. He was constantly looking in the rearview mirror.
It's light most favorable, but I think probably just about everybody in this courtroom, if there's a police officer car behind them following them regularly, they're going to keep checking their rearview mirror.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I know that that's not the strongest piece of evidence we have, but it has to all go into the
calculus. And they did exit the interstate.
They exited the interstate. Certainly, we have a note on his person that has the street value of oxycodone, which is a prescription opiate. As the Court of Appeals pointed out, it's not morphine, but it is definitely something that the trial court could reasonably infer that he is familiar with the illegal distribution of drugs in Spotsylvania County. He is with his brother, who has oxycodone that had been filled just 2 hours earlier. He was missing over 50 pills over a period of 2 hours. His brother has a notebook, which the Commonwealth's expert said was reflective of drug sales that he was keeping track of. His brother also said that he consumed all those pills within a period of 2 hours.
The oxycodone, where were they filled? Where was the pharmacy?
Yeah, sir. So he got the prescription in Arlington. He went to Fairfax to fill the prescription, and then he was found in Spotsylvania within a period of 2 hours. So if you drive from Arlington to Fairfax to Spotsylvania, it's a very short amount of time.
Did Roy have any other transportation other than his brother?
No, and I was going to say that. There was no evidence that he had any other transportation.
Is any evidence that he didn't?
There's no evidence that he didn't, but what we do have is that the evidence that his brother is the one driving. There's also evidence that Roy had a lot of possessions in the vehicle.
And the defendant himself had the oxycodone price list on it.
Yes, Your Honor. I think when you look at all of the circumstances...
You say a price list. I mean, was it really a price list, or was it just two different amounts of oxycodone that he always multiplied by the same dollar amount per milligram, none of which matched what his brother had?
Well, as to that...
I mean, if you have a price list, it seems like to me it would be 1 milligram equals, I forgot what the number was, $15, and that's really all you needed, as Judge Powell pointed out. Unless you have trouble with math, you didn't need to do the other part.
Yeah, the officer testified that it's about a dollar a milligram, and the sheet of paper that he had matches the street value of oxycodone.
Right, which is kind of like 1 times 60 equals 60, and if I have, you know, 50 of those times 50 is equal to, right.
Right, and you can do it's simple math, as the Court of Appeals pointed out. And also, I think the trial court...
Right, and how many... You know, cancer patients and sufferers of industrial accidents or whatever who have pain pills are worried about the street retail value of their prescriptions. I mean, so that's indicative of what they might be up to.
Yes, absolutely.
When you say they, what evidence do you have that there was an agreement between the brothers to do anything
together? Sure, moving
together?
On. You know, like intent, there's hardly ever any direct evidence of an agreement.
Right.
And it has to be relied upon circumstantial evidence.
But the only thing I see that connects the two is that one had oxycodone and the other one had a list that had one times the number of milligrams is equal to how much oxycodone is worth.
Okay. So I think you have two, they're fulfilling roles in this setup. You have the one with the oxycodone that had filled it 2 hours earlier. There's 50 missing. He has a notebook with maybe referencing drug sales. And then you have the defendant. He is actually driving the vehicle. He has the piece of paper with the street value of oxy. I know that there are different amounts. Just as Kelsey pointed out, the trial court pointed out that this may just be an old sheet of paper,
right?
Which they had an agreement. And today, maybe before they were selling 30 milligram. Today they have 15 milligrams.
Or maybe his brother's the oxycodone guy and he's the morphine guy.
Or he's the morphine guy and this is a one-stop shop. They can show up and say, what do you need? He's got morphine, he's got
the
oxy.
Reasonable fact finder would have to conclude they Chinese walled off these businesses as they're driving together up and down the interstate.
It's not even a Chinese wall. I mean, I guess I could see two guys working and it's like, whatever sales I make is the sales I make and the sales that you make are the sales that you make. It's like having two cars together in a shopping center. Just because the two stores are beside each other doesn't mean they work together.
Seems to me that your position is that one guy is the sales department and the other guy is the accounting department. And they're working together. One's got the book, the other's got the...
And the transportation. And the distribution center.
I guess the problem with that is the guy who supposedly is providing the transportation is also selling. I mean, because he just had morphine, something that was completely different from what the other guy was selling.
Yeah, but it's not like he had marijuana or something that's completely different. I mean, it's still an opiate.
Gotcha. Okay.
I mean, again, I know it's not the biggest piece of evidence, but they were both looking in the rearview mirror. And I believe, Your Honor, I have gone through the laundry list of circumstantial evidence in this case. This is an important case of the Commonwealth because as you don't need to look very far. You look at your local newspaper that opiate addiction is what is ravaging our communities. We would submit that this evidence was sufficient to convict this defendant of possession with intent to distribute opiate and conspiracy to distribute those drugs.
Could you address the dissent at the Court of Appeals on the distinction between conspiracy and aiding and abetting?
Yeah, it is difficult to distinguish the two in my mind. I think in this case, the circumstantial evidence is that these two had an agreement and that was planned ahead of time to do this. It wasn't that one defendant, Wayne, just came upon his brother and decided to aid and abet him and his distribution of drugs. I think the classic aiding and abetting situation is, the drug dealer on the corner who's selling drugs and another guy sees that the police are coming, he comes and says, hey, let's get out of here, and he aids and abets him in getting away from the cops. This, I think, is a situation where you have two people that are engaged, at least a reasonable inference that they are engaged in the drug distribution around the Commonwealth that morning, and maybe even before then. I think there is some overlap when you are trying to decide whether something is a conspiracy or aiding and abetting. I think in this instance, I think a trial court could reasonably find that there was a conspiracy between these two brothers. One point I do want to point out as to our procedural default argument, we will rely upon our brief on that. I will say that I don't think this court can reverse if you find that the morphine was insufficient. I think at best what the appellant gets is a remand to the Court of Appeals.
Did the appellant ask for that in this court?
That was in the prayer for relief, and I overlooked that in my when I did my brief. But when looking at their prayer relief, they do ask in the alternative that it be sent back to the Court of Appeals.
So whenever there's a independent ground that's not addressed for whatever reason, we would have to send it back to the Court of Appeals, even though it was not directly attacked in the assignment of error?
I don't think so. I think that what they should have done, as the court pointed out, was raise an assignment of error.
What would the error say?
That the Court of Appeals erred in not considering this other grounds.
And we say that the Court of Appeals was correct in the grounds it did consider, therefore it did not err in not considering the other one?
Yeah, I think so. Unless maybe I'm misunderstanding your question.
It erred in ducking.
It erred in ducking. I would never say the Court of Appeals would duck a question.
No, they considered the narrowest and best grounds, but they should have considered a different ground.
But if morphine were insufficient, they did err in ducking, because the argument presented to the Court of Appeals is, I shouldn't have a conviction for Schedule 1, Schedule 2. There are two ways I could have been convicted for that, and I can beat both of those. So that's the reason it has to be raised on appeal, because she has to win both those arguments. And if a trial court, or for that matter, if a appellate court doesn't address but one, it's error not to address the other if they're wrong on the one they did address.
And that is our position, unless I'm not trying. Maybe I misspoke when I answered your question. It seemed like I said I conceded something that I don't mean to concede. That is our position. But I just want to point out that they did ask for it in the prayer relief to be sent back to the Court of Appeals, and that's the best they could do. They did not get a complete reversal on the charge. Thank you, Your Honors.
Rebuttal? Affirm.
In regards to the conspiracy, Your Honor, you can see from the cases that I cited in my brief that just because two people are together doesn't make a conspiracy. That's not an inference that can be drawn. Just because they're together, they're working together. That's speculation. That goes beyond an inference.
Let me ask you this question. Your opposing counsel was wondering if you even made the argument at trial that you made this morning that the 10 remaining morphine pills may be his personal stash. Did you raise that argument to the trial court? And if so, do you happen to have the reference to the appendix handy? And don't spend a lot of your rebuttal time looking if you don't have it. But
it's in. I did note it in my reply brief with the parts in the joint appendix. I will say thing with appeals. When you go back and look at the record, you're definitely not as articulate as you've
been there. Yeah, I understand.
But I did speak multiple times about the nature of the intent having to be contemporaneous with the possession. And I think I quoted the correct law to the trial judge and gave him enough information that he could make a decision, because I did speak multiple times in regards to the conspiracy and the possession with intent to distribute about the intent having to be contemporaneous with the possession. I believe it's on page 9 of my reply brief. I believe okay. 9 and 10. It lists the pages in the joint appendix. Opposing counsel talked about some of the, what they believe to be circumstantial evidence of a conspiracy. He mentions the notebook, and the trial, the Commonwealth's expert, and I believe the Court of Appeals noted that, or the dissent in the Court of Appeals noted that what the expert says is that the notebook really had no bearing. The notebook didn't reference any drugs. It had some figures, but he couldn't really make heads or tails of it, and that's what the evidence was in regards to the notebook. In regards to looking in the rearview mirror, my client who was driving wasn't driving legally, and so that's probably another reason he was a little bit worried about the police behind him. In regards to the time that opposing counsel brought up, the fact that this was only 2 hours before, if there was no time to switch cars or drop him off or anything like that, then I would think there would also be no time to hide the money. There was absolutely no money found on either of these people if they were distributing in that period of time. There was no packaging. They said that the expert did say that with a small amount of drugs there would be no packaging, but this isn't a small amount of drugs. This is a lot of pills. There's no evidence of packaging. There's no evidence of distribution besides pills not being in the bottle. That's why we're asking that you overturn his conspiracy and remand the possession of the distribution.
All right. Thank you very much. Call the next case.